This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
This is Leo Gold, your host for the New Capital Show. I'm out of town this week, but I've put together reruns of some of my favorite monologues and interviews. The website for our show is www.newcapitalshow.com, where you can send me email, sign up for podcasts, and even state your own opinions on forums. And now, some of our greatest hits. Tuesday night, late Tuesday night, 11:30 p.m. to be exact, I stayed up to watch the president appear on the Charlie Rose show, the televised salon hosted by one of the country's great raconteurs. There I lay in the master bed, the light from the 1970s Sony glowing, my eyelids fighting to stay open. My wife these days is staying in the nursery with our newborn, waking with him several times a night so that I can take care of business during the day. And there I was, alone with the TV and Charlie and the president. And as I fell off into a drowse, I heard the president speaking about the so-called troop surge in Iraq, say that we need to give the chance a plan. This president, famous for his malaprops, had of course meant to say that we need to give his plan a chance. But unwittingly, the president had actually hit on something far more profound. Give the chance a plan, I thought, as my eyes fell shut and I fell asleep like an exhausted log. Waking the next morning, the words still echoed in my head. I remembered almost nothing that he had said other than, give the chance a plan. The chance, the opportunity. So many chances, so many opportunities have faced and continue to face this nation and the world, and so many go without plans commensurate with the magnitude of their need. On Wednesday, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation announced it will spend $60 million on making education the major issue in the next presidential election. My wife and I have been agonizing about where to send our two-year-old for school, public or private. While we have the financial resources to send our daughter to a wonderful private school, I agonize that such an education is not available to all in public schools. American schools, every single one of them, should be bastions of excellence. Where are the plans for this chance? The nation's energy production and consumption profile has been created out of a collection of external costs and subsidies, and now threatens our security and environment. The New Capital Show website now has a carbon calculator on its homepage. I calculated my own impact from my 2,000 square foot home and my 20 mile per gallon car, a staggering 50,000 pounds a year, 25 tons of CO2 from little old me alone. You can check yours at www.newcapitalshow.com. You and I and everyone else, as we now know, threaten the balance of nature with our activities. A combination of greater regulation, logical incentives to conserve, and technological advances constitute an enormous chance to change. Who will give the chance a plan? Centuries of logging, mining, dumping, and burning on this and all continents have resulted in environmental degradation, and the chance to make a plan for environmental renovation now exists. Such a plan would include cleaning land, water, and air, and protecting our beautiful places and fellow species. Who will give this chance a plan? Economic inequalities have grown drastically in the past few decades. The people of the world under the current system share few common laws and protections, and the wealthy engage in regulation arbitrage to seek the labor and lands of the least protected. A chance exists to improve social and economic justice while still remaining true to economic fundamentals of honest accounting and accurate measures of return on investment. Who will give the chance a plan? The president objects to Iran having a nuclear weapon, but has never once described the immense horror of our nation's own nuclear weapons arsenal. Nuclear weapons disarmament by the entire world is a chance begging for a plan. Who will give this chance a plan? U.S. government expenditures for the past decades have yielded little, no, or negative returns on investment. The response of our leaders has been to try to eliminate government or propose their own poor projects. A chance exists to reform government and the way that it evaluates and funds projects so that business, economic, and social principles are primary considerations. Who will give such a chance a plan? After 6 years in office, an insane and arrogant invasion of another country, a trashing of the Treasury's coffers, a determined ignorance of the main issues that we face, the sound of this president pleading that his foolish plans be given a chance. He finally seemed to get it right on Charlie Rose, albeit accidentally. Rather than giving his plans a chance, it's instead time that our chances be given real plans. I'm Leo Gold. This is the New Capital Show. Back in a moment. I interviewed some of the main funds practicing socially responsible investing. We talked about how these days it's possible to invest in a way that is both principled and profitable. My guests today are Adam Kanzer, General Counsel and Shareholder Advocacy Director at Domini Investment Group. Joe Keith, who is the CEO of Pax World Funds. I mentioned Pax World Funds in my introduction and monologue, one of the first, may have been the first, of the socially responsible funds. And Carsten Henningsen, who is chairman and portfolio manager at Portfolio 21. Are you all with me, gentlemen?
Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
Adam, Joe, and Carsten, welcome to the New Capital Show. It's a true pleasure to have you on this morning.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
As a socially responsible person and also as a fellow portfolio manager, let's turn to Joe Keith first. Joe, tell us about Pax World, the foundation of your company, when it was started, and what principles you're devoted to.
Well, you're right, Leo. We were the first broadly available, socially responsible mutual fund created in 1971 by two United Methodist ministers who wanted to start a fund that did not invest in the Vietnam War. Hence the name PAX, Peace, and since that time we have been, you know, at the forefront, I think, of the socially responsible investing industry and movement, and we continue to invest in what we think are, you know, forward-thinking companies with sustainable business models and integrating environmental and social and governance criteria into our investment decision-making and continuing to screen out weapons and tobacco and other problematic industries. And we have grown to a point where we're almost $2.5 billion, $2.4 billion in assets under management across three funds.
So three funds and $2.5 billion under management. And let's—I'd like to try to give people a feel for how big a fund family might be. I believe Fidelity Investments, which is one of the largest, maybe the largest, has about $1.7 trillion in assets under management. Is that your understanding of their size? Joe?
Yeah, I thought they were a little over a trillion. I didn't realize it was 1.7. They grow a lot faster than
you do. so just to give people an idea of where we are in the socially responsible spectrum of things, $2.5 billion versus almost, you know, let's call it $1.5 trillion, maybe. We'll compromise. Joe's got $1 trillion. I've got a version. $1.5 trillion. Great. Adam Kanzer, tell us a bit about Domini.
Sure, and thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it, and thanks for that provocative opening. I hope we can get into some.
We will. We're gonna go right at him. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Domini Social Investments, we focus exclusively on socially responsible investing. We now offer a global family of mutual funds, funds for that invest in U.S. stocks, European stocks. We just recently launched an Asia Pacific fund and a Euro Pacific fund as well, and a bond fund and a money market account. We were founded by Amy Domini, who is still our CEO. Amy just last year was honored by Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world, which we felt was really, you know, a credit to where the SRI industry has gone over the past 10 to 15 years, and we hope is a, you know, a hopeful sign that the market will be paying more attention to these issues. We're basically, I mean, to put it simply, because I think that socially responsible investing is a mouthful of a term, and it's one that I think none of us are all that thrilled with, but we're sort of stuck with. A better way, I think, of maybe looking at it is that in every aspect of our lives, we are taught that we need to take account for the consequences of our actions. The only area of our lives where we're told the exact opposite is investing. We're actually told that we're supposed to ignore the consequences of our actions. And economists call that rational behavior. Our firm was founded on the principle that the way you invest matters. And so we seek to understand the way investors act in the markets and how we can have the most positive influence. It's not about identifying perfect companies. It's not about perfection. It's about moving things in the right direction, because we're very concerned that historically things have been moving in the wrong direction.
It's a journey, then.
It's a journey. Yeah. I endorse the journey concept wholeheartedly.
Adam, tell us about the size of Domini so we get an understanding of the scale of your operations.
Right now we're at about $1.7 billion.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I'd say in general in the SRI industry, SRI is actually relatively small. If you just look at the firms that focus exclusively on social investing, our impact, however, has been, I think, significantly larger than our assets, which has been very interesting to me over the past few years to see, you know, companies continue to return our phone calls, which has been very interesting.
Tell us a little bit about that. What do you mean when you say your influence exceeds your actual size of assets under management?
Well, let me give you just one example. As you said in the introduction, you know, part of my role with Domini is that I direct our shareholder activism program. I don't know how familiar your listeners are with shareholder activism. But what we do once we hold the company, you know, we feel that our responsibilities as owners of that company are really just beginning. And so we engage on a regular basis with the companies in our portfolio, both through our proxy voting practices. You know, you get to elect the board every year. You get to vote on all sorts of matters that, that the company presents. And also, as more engaged investors, we write letters to companies on our portfolio to raise issues of their social and environmental performance. We file shareholder resolutions to appear on company proxy statements. And in the United States, in order to file a shareholder resolution, all you need to do is hold $2,000 worth of stock for a year.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very low threshold. But with that, and we generally hold far more than that, but it's still a very small percentage compared to, you know, the company's outstanding shares, certainly compared to what Vanguard and Fidelity hold. But it's enough to get the company's attention, and it has enabled us to get into some very long and very involved discussions with a wide range of companies on a wide range of social and environmental issues, and we've seen a lot of progress.
Very good. Thank you, Adam. Carsten Henningsen, you are the chairman and I think lead portfolio manager at Portfolio 21. Welcome to the New Capital Show. Tell us a little bit about your firm and your funds.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here. Portfolio 21 is a global equity mutual fund. And we started about 7.5 years ago with a focus on environmental sustainability. And since that time, we've been proving through competitive performance and a lot of interest from investors that there's actually a business case and an investment case for environmental sustainability. In other words, there's real opportunities in understanding the ecological crisis, trying to find companies that truly recognize the opportunities that exist to save money by saving natural resources and by providing products and services, technologies that are needed to create a sustainable society going forward.
And how big is Portfolio 21?
We're just getting ready to celebrate $200 million.
Wonderful! Congratulations. So you're a smaller fund than the other two. You've been around for a lot less time. How is that? Does that make you different from Joe and Adam's funds or fund families that you would point out to us?
Right, yes. We've been around for 7.5 years, and the fund has been doubling almost every year, so we've got some great momentum. Our fund specifically is focused on global, so we're about 30% U.S. stocks, and the remainder are all international stocks in developed countries with a focus in Northern Europe, where we have a lot of leadership around environmental sustainability.
I read my daughter books, usually at bedtime. We curl up in the evening quiet, the low light of a single lamp casting shadows on the wall, just enough illumination to see the words and pictures. One book is about dinosaurs. It's strange, the book describes these creatures in such friendly and loving terms. I warm up my voice and put inflections on it, spin and gurgle the words happily for her. Tyrannosaurus, Brontosaurus, Diplodocus. I pronounce the words and stop and look at her. She stares intently at the book, running her finger gently over her mouth as if practicing the pronunciation of these daunting words. After a while, it's easy to forget that we are reading a book about species that long ago went extinct on Earth and have never, ever been seen alive by human eyes. And yet clearly we humans have no difficulty writing dreamy books about them. And we create a sense of love and affection for them in our children. Imaginary creatures of epic scale in long ago places. Startlingly, I realize one of the first words my daughter will ever learn will be dinosaurs. A group of massive amphibians that roamed the planet millions of years ago. Other books I read to her are about other animals contemporaneous with humans. Yet that is about the only difference from dinosaurs, for the authors still create the same warm, loving environments around these other animals as they do for dinosaurs. Lions, tigers, zebras, whales, dolphins, seals, hippos, rhinos. We were at a holiday party recently, and Abby took a tiger ornament from the Christmas tree and approached everyone. "Roar!" she roared, jamming the little tiger in every face she could find. Her mother takes her to the Houston Zoo so she has seen these animals, if only from afar. And then other books are about the only animals she is ever likely to see in any great numbers, those that we have domesticated. Cows that say moo, horses that say neigh, pigs that oink, sheep that baa, and ducks that quack. For Abby, there is not much difference between all of these animals, the dinosaurs, the tigers, the cows. They are all animals. They are all cute. They all make her happy. I'm no child psychologist, but animals, even those that do not exist, apparently play major roles in the development of children. And the books that we read together are ultimately, to her, a jumble mishmash of brontosauruses, rhinos, and cows. Only later in life will she learn that brontosauruses are long gone, that cows are everywhere we want them to be, and that the last of the rhinos were, at the current rate, probably killed off during her childhood by the same human species that so lovingly portrayed them for Abby in her books. Last week, a special expedition to the Yangtze River in China, Asia's longest river and previously akin to the Amazon in its biological diversity, formally declared that the Baiji, the white river dolphin that once happily swam the Yangtze, is extinct. As Andrew Revkin, science writer for the New York Times, writes, for some 20 million years, the Baiji, also called the white flag dolphin, frequented the Yangtze's sandy shallows, using sonar to catch fish in the silty flow. In the last few decades, the dolphin's numbers plunged as rapidly as the Chinese economy surged. The Yangtze's sandy shallows, which the Baiji frequented, have largely been dredged for shipping. The Baiji sought fish that have been netted or driven from the river by pollution, and its sonar may have been disrupted by the propeller noise from boats above. A 1997 survey counted 13 Baiji in the river. None of the dolphins survive in captivity. Where does natural selection leave off and stupidity start? What is the point of intelligence if it leads to the destruction of our Earth and its species? What is the point of compassion if we select uncaring leaders ill-equipped to lead? For me, the news of the demise of the Baiji calls into question the very purpose and meaning of our own existences. Our current leader declares that this century's main battle will be with fundamental Islam, rather than, as I believe, for the health of the planet. His advisors have probably never passed him a briefing paper on the Baiji, on the plight of polar bears on a warming planet. Of the many species now struggling in the wake of the immense success achieved by humans in the past 10,000 years since crops and animals were domesticated. Or perhaps he has received the news but cannot be bothered to care or does not believe that he has either power or responsibility to act on behalf of the poor creatures that now depend upon our kindness and our mercy. The pragmatic among us will declare that the Baiji failed to adapt, failed to expand its environment beyond one river to others, failed to adapt to massive human intrusion on and destruction of its habitat, and therefore was naturally doomed to extinction. But that is blaming the victim. The truth is that the human world, yet again, failed to utilize its intelligence and innate compassion, its Buddha nature, to save a beautiful and helpless creature. So many products that I buy these days arrive in cargo containers by ship from China. My heart is heavy these days as I slowly awake to recognize the escalating price of those products and how little of that price is reflected in what I actually pay. Now the Baiji dolphin is added to the cost, and yet global consumers of Chinese products, me included, will in all likelihood never pay that cost until it's too late. As one Chinese economist says, it is becoming more difficult for governments to count on the beauty of investment covering up 100 other kinds of ugliness. One day, I hope, it may be that my daughter will read books to her daughter. They will cozy up at bedtime, the lights dimmed, under the covers, a heartwarming scene of a species rearing its offspring with love and caring. They will read about animals, dinosaurs, rhinos, cows, toucans, and maybe even a story about a little white river dolphin in a faraway place, a kind of swimming unicorn. The story will be happy as the little dolphin frolics and plays all day and turns in with its mama at night. And there will probably be a small sticker on the back cover of the book. And my daughter's daughter will stare intently at the cute creature in the book, not knowing that, like the dinosaurs before it, the little dolphin once truly lived on Earth, not only made in China, but also betrayed in China. I'm Leo Gold. This is the New Capital Show.
Beluga in the deep blue sea, swim so wild and you swim so free. Heaven above and the sea below, and a little white whale on the go. Baby beluga, baby beluga, is the water warm? Is your mama home with you? So happy. Way down yonder where the dolphins play, where you dive and splash all day. Waves rolling and the waves roll out, see the water squirting out of your spout. Baby beluga, oh baby beluga, sing your little song, sing for all your friends, we like to hear.
Next up on our collection of greatest hits, on March 1st, I spoke to Jim Marston of Environmental Defense about his role in fighting TXU Corporation's coal-fired power plants and his role in working on the sale of the company to new, more environmentally friendly owners. Jim, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure to have you on. And this was undertaken by Environmental Defense and other organizations as well.
Absolutely. We took the lead, but it wasn't only our fight. I mean, many grassroots groups sprung up. Some other statewide groups were very helpful, like Public Citizen and SEED. You know, frankly, when we got in the fight, we thought there's a lot of people told us there's no way you can win. The TXU has the governor and the regulatory agency on their side. You know, environmental groups are weak in Texas. We just thought it was such a bad plan they had that we had to make the fight regardless and see what might happen.
Yeah. Now, of course, the involvement of municipalities must have been an enormous help.
Oh, that's right. I mean, this was a fight that was on many fronts. It was legislative. It was a press fight. It was organized at the grassroots level, but also was a litigation fight. And the fact that the cities brought their voice in, were able to get a really good law firm to do pro bono work, the Sussman Godfrey firm, and to help raise money for expert witnesses, certainly meant that these permits that were pending were no sure thing.
Yep. So, what happened? Basically, we began to see a change in the tenor of the battle. It seemed that TSU was going to press ahead, try to use the governor to fast-track this proposal to put these coal plants in. All sorts of NGOs came together. Was there national support at the NGO level? Were you receiving support from national offices as well?
Yes. Well, we spent the vast majority of the money on the campaign. A lot of groups helped us. The National Wildlife Federation was doing some work, Sierra Club, NRDC. A lot of it was spontaneous on their part, though on occasion we'd call and say, couldn't you do something?
And so a few weeks ago, Environmental Defense received a call. Is that what happened?
Out of the blue, 2 weeks ago yesterday, we received a call from William Riley, who had been the head of U.S. EPA under Bush 1, and said they were thinking about buying TXU, but they would only go through with the deal if we and another group that they had relationships with, NRDC, would review and be willing to say out loud that they had a really precedent-setting global warming plan.
Mm-hmm.
They had not yet closed the deal at that point on price, and we didn't hear anything for almost a week. And then last Tuesday, I received another call from Riley that said they had a deal on price, but they still had one hurdle, and that was that we had to be willing to say that what they were claiming about their global warming plan was really true, and could I come out to San Francisco to meet with him the next morning?
So here you are, a regional director in environmental defense, an NGO, being called out to the local, to the San Francisco offices of two of the most powerful financial players in the world. Is that right?
That's right.
And what are you thinking on the airplane?
I'm thinking, I don't know if I want this responsibility. I'm thinking, this is a great opportunity, but I better make sure that it really is a good plan, and I'll be able to tell people 10 years from now we got a good deal.
I mean, it's an enormous burden that fell on your shoulders, Jim Morrison.
Well, I must confess, I did not sleep much the night before the meeting, and I have slept very little since then.
So in many ways, as you flew on that airplane, you were carrying the hopes and dreams of many progressive Texans on your shoulders. I think that's fair to say. Is that right?
Well, I will say I felt that burden. Whether it was everybody else thought I was carrying that their hopes and dreams, I don't know. But I did feel exactly that.
Mm-hmm. And so you went out there with this responsibility. Environmental Defense, one of the two groups that has been called in to this meeting with Texas Pacific Group and Colbert Kravis Roberts. These are, and by the way, Texas Pacific Group is kind of based in Texas, right? I mean, they, David Bonderman, the head, lives in Fort Worth, but they've got offices in the other power centers.
That's correct.
And so you're on your way to this meeting to look at this plan and basically decide and make an evaluation as to whether it meets muster.
That's exactly right. And they had a few teasers. They said they were willing to withdraw 8 of their permit applications. That was a big deal to us.
Mm-hmm.
But they also told us that they were willing to withdraw their plans to build the same kind of conventional coal plants in Pennsylvania and Virginia. We had already begun gearing up opposition to TXU in those states as well. And the fact that they were going to withdraw in those other states was a big deal to us, because we care not only about local air pollution in Texas, but the main focus of our group these days is global climate change or global warming.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the meeting.
Well, I've told my friends it was among the oddest 17 hours I spent in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a room with three people from Texas Pacific Group and one person from KKR.
And Frederick Gultz represented KKR?
That's right.
So Frederick Gultz and then William Riley, who was the former EPA administrator under, was it Bush?
Under Bush 1, right.
Under Bush 1. So William Riley, who was the former EPA administrator, who now basically is one of these sort of adjunct partner consultants for TPG.
Yes.
Sort of one of the industry-specific guys that, for those of you listening, basically these finance groups hire industry-specific people to help advise them on their deals, to give them industry-specific knowledge. Is that right? So what Riley is there on the environmental side of things, and he's got two lieutenants there as well.
That's correct.
And presumably you meet in a really nice building in San Francisco.
I think it was nice. You know, basically, I go up to a conference room. We spend many hours there.
Oh.
Through another conference room, I make phone calls to my colleagues. But we were so focused and concentrated, I didn't really tour the offices or anything.
Yeah. So you get down to looking at this plan. Now, this is the first time you've seen this plan, or they sent you advanced documentation on it?
They sent me a page and a half of ideas by fax right before I got on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And then we start talking about what it means.
Mm-hmm.
I basically, first I went through it in the head there, and I told them parts of it that I thought were meaningful, parts I had questions about, and parts that were not all that impressive, and I didn't care very much about those.
Mm-hmm.
And we began a series of conversations. You know, I would suggest other things they could do, or I would suggest more specificity with regard to a particular paragraph. They would, either accept or reject or want, try to tell me why they couldn't do the plan. We went back and forth. You thought you were making progress, and then I thought it wasn't good enough, and then we stepped back and tried to approach it from a different angle. I would call my colleague from NRDC, David Hawkins, several times during the day, get his input on language, ideas, how we were at impasse. Was there some way that we could get what we wanted but not go up against what they were saying they couldn't do?
Uh-huh.
I also talked to my big boss, as I call him, the president of Environmental Defense, Fred Krupp, and got his help several times.
Mm-hmm. And a deal was hammered out.
Yes, it was. We kind of had a tentative deal at 5:30 in the evening. Then they called their people and I called my people, and both our phone calls resulted in some questions, and the deal that we had probably wasn't quite what we could go with. So we got back together again at about 8:30 at night and struggled very hard to get a final deal that everybody could live with. And literally, I guess maybe 11:30, we had some conceptual ideas, and then we wrote and edited back and forth about 1 a.m. that morning.
A photograph sticks in my mind. It sat on a shelf in the home of the father of a friend of mine. There is the father, decked out in khaki and olive fly fishing garb, smiling bright and wide with a rushing whitewater river in the background. And George Herbert Walker Bush, the U.S. 41st president, and James Jimmy Baker flanking the father on either side. Presumably, it was happier times than now. Neither George W. Bush nor my friend are anywhere to be seen in that photograph. But don't kid yourself. They know the people in the photograph and know them well. Two fathers and one's best friend and political sidekick. And with W. Bush now struggling for his political life, and with Iraqis struggling daily for real life, the George Herbert Walker Bush, James Addison Baker, and their men have reappeared to help the son. And yet the son, still evidently struggling to be his own man, exists in a White House handler-induced bubble act of appearing to hold the fatherly advisors with cautious regard so that he can still cling to the illusion that he is in power and that he himself is responsible for his being in power. What occurs now is just the next chapter in the same psychodrama that has been the life of George W. Bush since he skipped out of the Vietnam War, failed to develop a career, developed alcoholism, found Jesus Christ, made some funny money, and climbed aboard his father's coattails to sail into destiny. The Iraq Study Group, headed by Jimmy Baker, has released its report. Some think it not drastic enough. Others are surprised at its sobering tone, stating that Iraq is bad and getting worse, and that time is running out. But in its essence, the Iraq Study Group represents a rebuke of George W. Bush by those who put him in power, his father and his men. It represents an official document, in part written by a group of Dr. Victor Frankensteins, anxious to rein in their monster before he does more damage to their party, to their friendships, and to the country that has yielded them so much wealth and comfort. And they may wonder, having made George W. Bush the president, if it's out of their hands and dependent upon the one thing that they never could have imagined that they would be subservient to, George W. Bush, the son. The study group's document says many things, but privately, I imagine, the fathers are thinking one thing, and one thing only. We put the son in, and if he doesn't follow this report, we will not allow him to remain with power. And I suspect they're right. George W. Bush may think he is in control, but he no longer is. The only remaining drama is how willingly he will follow. For the rest of us, it doesn't really matter. He was once George Herbert Walker Bush and Jimmy Baker's problem, and he is now again. Sometimes I think about the fly fishing photograph, the one in the living room of my friend's father. I've fallen somewhat out of touch with my friend, as we've talked only a few times in the past few years, and briefly at that. I can't help but think that George W. Bush's presidency has taken a toll on our friendship, and in truth, I think it has. Early on, I spoke up vocally against this president, and my friend didn't like what I had to say. The last time I saw the friend and the father together, several years ago, they both told me I should prepare myself to fight a multi-generational long war against radical Islam. And yet here is James Baker, their model, producing a report prescribing a standing down of U.S. forces a few years after their admonition to me. It is no wonder that the nation voted no confidence in the fathers and the sons in the recent midterm election, and may vote no confidence in them again, as I hope happens until such time as they show that they are capable of reforming their minds and their ways. I recently decided to try and catch up with my friend, and I did it in the modern way, by Googling him. And lo and behold, there he was, a new job with a new investment firm, a board position on a nonprofit, and, courtesy of one of those campaign finance disclosure sites, a $250 donation to George W. Bush's 2004 presidential campaign. My tally of the waste now stands at hundreds of thousands of lives, $2 trillion according to the Iraq Study Group report, and $250. One of the men in the fly fishing photograph, James Addison Baker, scion of a venerable Houston family, descendant of one of the founders of Rice University, one of our nation's premier institutes of learning, enlightenment, and knowledge, may now act as if the decision is George W. Bush's. But all of the men in the photograph, Baker included, know that they, the fathers, as much as anyone, are responsible for what has happened in Iraq. After all, if you read Frankenstein, it's awfully hard to blame the monster. I'm Leo Gold. This is the New Capital Show. Back in a moment.
Just the other day, he came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking for I knew it, and as he grew, he'd say, I'm gonna be like you, Dad, you know I'm gonna be like you.
It's no exaggeration to say that George Kinder is the father of life planning, a burgeoning area of counsel that generally is integrated into existing financial advisory practices. I'm a financial advisor, an investment manager, a wealth manager, call it what you want. And over the course of 2 days in October, I participated in a small, intimate workshop with Kinder and found myself and my practice transformed. I came away believing that Kinder's ideas and methods, life planning, has profound implications for the country and our culture, because it presents the possibility of people living happy lives, unburdened by flawed conceptions about money. Whether your ideas about money are your own, come from your parents, or from our own money-obsessed society, Kinder's methods can help gain personal wisdom and insight. On this special edition of The New Capital, George Kinder, guru to a new breed of financial advisors through his Kinder Institute, and the author of The Seven Stages of Money Maturity, makes a rare appearance to discuss money, spirit, and life, and how one should best think about them.
Leo, great to hear your voice.
It's great to hear yours as well. How have you been?
I've just been great, and it's a wonderful privilege to be on your show.
Do we have a money problem in this culture, in our culture?
Well, you know, I think it's very interesting. I listened to your wonderful synopsis of my work to lead into the show, and this question of what are we missing in life, and how does money have to do with it? I think we use money as an excuse for all the reasons that we're not doing what we really want to do with our life. And I think that's fundamentally what we're addressing in life planning, is we look at what does a person most profoundly want to accomplish, what gives them most meaning in their life, and then looks at how the money has played a role in not allowing us to move there. And it's often, sometimes it's money, sometimes it's time, but as Ben Franklin used to say, time is money. And we figure out in life planning, what we do is we find a way to inspire the client to actually live the life of their dreams. What is it they really want to accomplish? Who is it that they really want to be? And we find a way as well to strip away all of the money excuses. So in a way, I think that money is a problem. We can analyze it societally and say, well, gosh, we're too attached to it, we're too materialistic. But those are just kind of philosophical arguments that don't get you anywhere. They're bull sessions. What gets you somewhere is, in fact, confronting how you're buying into that. You know, one of the wonderful things is we all say, oh, it's such a materialistic culture when we talk to each other, and we're thinking about everybody else but you and me. But, in fact, it's all of us that are caught in it.
So, really, the problem that you're defining is that people tend to put themselves second. They tend to put their own lives second to something else, whether that's cultural notions of finance and money, or material, or some other standard. But am I hearing that in your comment that we don't put ourselves and our own lives front and center in our own thinking processes?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct, and it's very subtle, Leo, because some of the polls are our dear and tender pulls. For instance, the pull to educate our kids, to have the home that our spouse wants, or the vacations. The problem, it's not that those things are a problem. The problem is that we haven't weighed all the different ways that we spend money against what it is that we really want out of our life. And when you do that kind of balancing, that kind of weighing, some surprising things emerge that, in fact, give us the promise and the possibility of real and genuine freedom and authenticity in our lives.
And so, this idea of life planning, this whole area of life planning, I said that you're the father of it, and that's, to my understanding, that is the case, but it came out of your own financial advisory practice. You developed these concepts while working as a financial advisor.
That's correct.
And you felt that there was something missing from your practice of giving advice.
Well,
help us understand how it is that we made this, or that you made this leap from financial advisory to this more robust model called life planning.
Yeah. There are a couple of things. One is that it actually came out of my personal life as much as out of my relationship with clients. In terms of clients, I was trained as a financial planner to ask the traditional questions about what kind of house do you want, or do you want a second home, or what kind of vacations do you want to take, when do you want to retire, how do you want to educate your kids, and none of the questions were really looking at the person sitting with me and saying, what really juices you in life, what really excites you, what is it that you would feel that you profoundly missed if you didn't accomplish in life? Those are the real questions that money is meant to address. Money and meaning should be married, and that's one of the things we're doing in life planning. So what happened with my clients was that they'd surprise me. They would tell me the things about retirement and kids' education and their home or whatever, and then suddenly out of the blue they'd completely shift what it was that they were doing. They might not have the resources to in fact accomplish the dreams that I thought they had, and the reason was that something else was much more important to them, and it had never come out in the conversation.
Your book is called Seven Stages of Money Maturity. Seven Stages of Money Maturity. It was published, I don't know, a few years ago. You give several case studies in the book that really help a reader understand what an example of life planning might be, but also examples that might help them understand what's going on in their own lives. Can we do one of those case studies from the book, maybe one that comes to the top of your mind, and help people understand how problems around money develop and can be resolved?
Sure. Is there one that comes to your mind, Leo? It's actually been about 6 years ago now, 7 years ago. So one doesn't come quickly to mind. I'm thinking in some way that my own life is an illustration of this. As I mentioned earlier, we have an exercise.
Well, great. Let's go through it. There are a few in here, but let's go through you.
Yeah, that we have an exercise in the book that I think really gets to the heart of what a person cares about and what they want to accomplish. It's called the three questions.
Mm-hmm.
And the first question is, if you had all the money that you needed in life, how would you live your life? And so we encourage the client to really dream and come up with all the things they'd love to do, have fun doing. The second question gets more serious. If you only had 5 to 10 years left to live, and you're going to live it healthy, but sometime 5 to 10 years from now, you're just going to keel over. The question is, what then would you do? You know, we're getting down to what's really much more important to you. And the third question has the most profound bite to it and really gets down to bedrock. And that third question is, if you suddenly discovered you only had 24 hours left to live, what did you miss? Who did you not get to be? What did you not get to do? And that question tends to get right at what it is that a person yearns to accomplish, what it is that's most important that they accomplish in their life. And there are often things that are not addressed in a financial plan. I can give an example from myself, but they fall into categories. Often they have to do with family or with relationship, perhaps healing a relationship with one's son or one's daughter or one's spouse. Sometimes they have to do with, I think the second most common category has to do with spirit. It may be that someone wants to live a more deeply spiritual life or wants to live a life of greater integrity. And the third most common category has to do with creativity, that someone wants to play the guitar like Eric Clapton or write the great American novel. These are the most common. The others that come up quite frequently are giving back to your community and giving back to the environment.
So generally, we don't hear a lot of, I'd like to have 15 yachts and 20 houses and more and more and more stuff.
That's exactly right. And that's the dilemma. That's the perplexity. That's why life planning is taking off so powerfully in the financial planning community, because we're finally realizing, gosh, this is what people really want. It's not the yachts. It's not necessarily even the homes. There's a quality of life that is so important and that money has a great deal to do with.
You mentioned the financial planning community. I took part in one of your workshops recently and was very, very influenced by it. And one of the things that you described in the workshop was that the book that you wrote, The Seven Stages of Money Maturity, that you were expecting that it would have a lot of impact on the end user audience, that is, just average people who go into bookstores and purchase books. But in fact, it had its largest influence among the financial planning community, the financial advising community. And in fact, that community picked up, has run with the book, and this really is your focus now, is to train the trainers, as it were.
That's right. This really stunned me. I thought that the consumer, the end user, as you put it, would be the one who would be really excited about the book, learn from the book. And the last person I thought would be really excited about it was the financial community, because I think I held many of the stereotypes of the financial community that the general public has, that there's a certain level of greed or just not the consumer interest, that is not the first interest of financial people. I think that was a bias that I felt as well. And what I found instead was that there is a tremendous feeling within the community among the very good people who are doing the work of financial planning to really care about who the client is, that it's actually a caring profession.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that this doesn't say that the stereotype that we had isn't something to watch out for and to be careful about.
Which is what? Describe the stereotype of, we're talking Wall Street and brokers and this kind of boiler room type idea, is that right?
Yeah, so I think the stereotype is the famous joke about yachts, that the broker takes you down to the bay and shows you his company's yacht and shows you his own yacht, and you go, well, but where are your clients' yachts? And they're not there. And so the notion is that the advisor really is thinking pretty much mostly for him or herself and really out for the money. And what surprised me was that there was a powerful group of leaders in the financial planning community who really cared absolutely first and foremost for their clients and were disturbed by the kinds of questions, by the kinds of concerns that I was beginning to wrestle with my own clients, in that they would come in and as we really held serious conversations, they'd talk about their family or their creativity or their spirit, and gosh, we didn't have a context to put it in. We didn't know what to do with it. And that was one of the reasons that I then wrote the book, was to find a way to contextualize what is our normal experience around money, and how can we find a way to marry meaning and money so that it no longer stands in the way of what we want to accomplish in our life, but in fact funds it.
You were listening to the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host, and my guest today is George Kinder, who is the founder of the Kinder Institute, the author of Seven Stages of Money Maturity. And you have a new book for advisors out,
yes,
George, is that right?
It's called Lighting the Torch.
Lighting the Torch, which really is what you want those who go through your training to do for their clients, to light the torch of life for their clients.
Yes. In fact, there's a particular methodology that we use, and actually a moment in a relationship between an advisor and a client that we call the lighting the torch moment, and it's where the client just gets really excited and goes, yes, why didn't my broker talk to me about this? Why has no advisor ever talked to me about this in the past? This is exactly what I want for life, for my life. We call it lighting the torch.
Well, that does it for another edition of the New Capital Show. I hope you enjoyed our collection of greatest hits. I'll be back with you next week when we'll be in the middle of KPFT's Summer Fun Drive. Today's show was produced by Kevin Wilcutts and by Luke Jones. And as always, you can find us on the web at www.newcapitalshow.com. Take care.
Tour de Pink is back. On Sunday, September 9, Pink Ribbons Project will host its third annual fundraising bicycle ride, Tour de Pink 2007. Cyclists will raise money for Pink Ribbons Project, In Motion Against Breast Cancer. Contributions and pledges will fund awareness and education programs, mammograms for underserved women, and other outreach programs. Last year, over 1,000 riders registered and rode. This year, it's another family-friendly event with routes from 12 to 100 miles. It starts and ends on the Prairie View A&M University campus near Hempstead. So grab your bikes and join us Sunday, September 9 at 7:30 a.m. on the start line. To register or volunteer, visit tourdepink.org on the web. That's tourdepink.org.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.